Heartstone by Age Last. Read by Abby Forth. What is a friend? A single soul dwelling in two bodies. 1. He felt a pain like the breaking of a rib, a thread cut. Mithras was on foot now. His horse had been killed from under him some time ago. Disoriented, he staggered back and took a hit. A troll, stark white and hideous, gained on him. He spun on his heels. The clank of armor did nothing to disguise the unmistakable crunch of bones. His bones. This is how it ends, a high and panicky voice shouted in his head. But one of his warriors came forward and thrust his sword into the creature's wide belly, and then was battered aside like a doll belonging to a petulant child. And then Mithras was back, his sword seemingly welded back into his hand. He hacked at the creature's body until black blood gushed from its wounds, until it was felled, until he had cleaved off its head. The battle ebbed and flowed around him, both on the ground and in the air. What a sight it must be from there! The sky above was black with smoke and molten with flame. Winged things that swooped down and brought death from above, and everywhere there was a monstrous cacophony, a constant roar of many voices, screaming, shouting, dying. A stiff wind blew through the battlefield, taking with the heavy scent of fast decay. The fighting continued, but they were being pushed back, further and further away from Fingon's forces. There was no hope, now, that they should meet. Through the thick, filthy air, Mithros strained to see Fingon's banner, blue and silver, but through the murk he could not make it out. Little by little it seemed to him that the fighting eased, and Morgoth's forces seemed to shift westward, towards Fingon's line. Soon, the battlefield seemed to have emptied, except for the dead and dying, and he looked around for a place to sit. He finally found one in a ruined shelter, sat down on a lump of something or other, dust, rose. Mithras wished so terribly to sleep. Something stirred weakly under his feet. He crushed it with his heel, with no thought of whether it was an ally or not. Other elves came trickling in, and some of Beor spoke too, and a makeshift hospital coalesced around him. Eventually, he looked around Delhi to find if any of his brothers had made through the slaughter. He found Cadenthyr sitting quite nearby, with a great gash on his head, the blood painting his face even redder. Mithras came over, and they stared at each other for a long moment, before Cadenthyr, moved by some phantom spirit of generosity, dug out from a pack at his side a stained and half-empty water skin, and offered it to him. Mithras' lips were dry, and the water tasted stale and faintly bloody, though the taste could have come from his fingers or his face. He drank it, almost dry, before Cadenthyr's noise of protest stopped him short. Then, wiping his mouth, Mithras spoke, his voice scratchy and hoarse, as if he had been screaming all the while. Perhaps he had been. "We must find the others," Cadenthyr grunted, "if they yet live." They did yet live, all of 7 of them, by some miracle, or more likely, by Morgoth's special design. Mithras, sitting once again on a horse that wasn't his, it was one of the few still left living, afforded one last look at the battlefield. That wide and broken plain, once dry and gasping, had now been suffused with a glut of blood, beyond all compare. Try as he might, Mithras could not see any glint of gold in the horizon, nor silver, or blue. news came months later from a ragged and nameless man of Dor Loman who was still dressed in the threadbare colors of the House of Hador. A deserter, perhaps, and survivor because of it. He claimed to have news of all who were lost. He twitched and shied away from the stares Mithros and his remaining followers gave him. But he was starving, and they had food. And so, as he ate their meager bread and nibbled at their stringy meat, with great gusto and concentration, and silently. Finally, Mithros had had enough. He asked for whatever the news the man had. He was not an old man, the soldier, but the elements had dealt harshly with him. He spat, and a glob of spit landed near Mithros' boot. Mithros repressed the urge to snarl. "Speak," he said instead. And the man swallowed hard and did, stumbling over many words in his confusion. It was as they had feared, and as they had guessed. Mithros took the news of the High King's death with a stoic expression on his face. His hand pressed gently, absently, against his side, as if to nurse a broken rib. Two. A single candle lit Mithros' sick bed, and all else was dark. The dark gave an impression of gigantic, looming places, of palaces long since put out of mind, across a frozen ocean. Fingon's hands were cold as he pushed away the heavy velvet curtains that hid Mithros from view. He should not have been here at all, but he had argued and badgered his way through the line of his relations to get here, into Mithros' quiet room, where his cousin still slept, and a single candle burned. Mithros' face was white as the sheet that surrounded him, his bright hair cut almost to his scalp. Fingon swallowed his outrage at this latest insult to his cousin's dignity. No doubt those who had done it had had good reason for it, and hair grows back, he thought, his eyes lingering on the bump in the blankets where Mithros' right arm lay. A noise, halfway between some lost word and sigh, interrupted his thoughts. Mithros' eyes cracked open, steely gray, and only slightly softened with sleep. "Ah, there you are," he seemed to say, and shifted into a seated position. He then adopted an attitude of heavy expectation, of waiting for the axe to fall, for the sword to swing. They had much to talk about, after all, much to explain to each other. Mithros pushed away his blankets. The stump of his right hand was yet neatly bandaged up, inoffensive in every way except by its very existence. Fingon sat on Mithros' bed and angled his body toward his cousin's. They watched each other, suddenly wary in each other's presence. Silence reigned for a while, until Fingon stirred, impatiently. "Have you taken a look outside?" Whatever Mithros was expecting, it wasn't this. He lifted a weary eyebrow. That Fingon, neither saying yes nor no, but Fingon took it as an assent. He got up and ventured forth to the window and pulled back curtains of the large southern-facing windows. The late afternoon light filtered into the room, gold and yellow. Motes of dust swirled upward, disturbed by his movements. From Maglor's worried reports, Fingon knew that Mithros had not let the cleaners into his rooms for almost a week now. And, indeed, the whole place smelled close, and if not of sickness, then certainly not of good health. He pushed back the final set of curtains, the ones of Mithros' bed, with a sigh. "There are entirely too many curtains here." He fingered the material idly. It was thicker and much more fine than the cloth that made up his own cloak. Feanorians, of course, would have the best of everything. Mithros blinked at the sudden influx of light. He struggled a little with his bedsheets and when free of that, swung his legs out of the bed. He wore only a nightshirt. Bingon could see the lines of strain on his shoulders, and how thin and wasted his legs seemed to look. Mithros compressed his lips and furrowed his brow. "Come here," he said. With anyone else, it would have been a plea. Bingon came, and together, with some missteps and stumblings, they at last made it to the window. Mithros leaned against him, hip to hip. They were almost the same height, though Bingon had no hope that he would ever quite catch up with Mithros in this regard. Bingon tried to keep his grip light, as unobtrusive as possible. Mithros was even lighter, and he looked fragile indeed. He moved, it seemed to Bingon, more through a fierce sense of determination than any great strength. Bingon felt a familiar surge of love and admiration for Mithros, the kind that burned in his belly and spread to his heart, sawing that organ out still further. Once, naively, he had thought that nothing could ever part of them. Nothing could have made them doubt each other. But he knew better now. Mithros turned to look at him. He laid his hand flat on the pane of glass. "Open this?" "Yes, of course," Bingon said, reluctant to let him go. But Mithros remained upright while Bingon opened the window. It took some doing. Superior Noldoran craftsmanship that had obviously gone into its making. The cold made the joints seize a little, and when Bingon did manage to open up the window fully, a strong cold breeze came into the room, ruffling Bingon's hair and pulling at Mithra's nightshirt. Though the sky was clear and the light of the setting sun, the wind brought with it a promise of a night of rain. Before them stretched the lake of clouded silver, and the dark line of trees beyond it, and beyond that, mountains wreathed in shadows and in mist, and beyond that, he couldn't yet say. A new world, Bingon offered instead, setting his hand down to rest on the windowsill. Mithros nodded and put his hand next to Bingon's, and they looked out together. Three. Bendicano was like a millstone around his neck, but patience, as his mother said, was a virtue. Maitimo hoisted up Bendicano's legs again with barely a sigh. Usually, Nerdinel said this a little impatiently after Bayonetta went into one of his passions again, but the general concept still held, or so Maitimo supposed. "Still tired?" Maitimo said, and his cousin nodded, burying his face in Maitimo's hair. It seemed odd that a child as boundlessly energetic as Bendicano should suddenly wilt and stumble and demand to be carried home, but there it was. They walked through a garden, gently buzzing with the sounds of summer. Everywhere flowers bloomed, a confusing abundance of reds and yellows, blues and greens. Laurelin was just past its zenith, and the light was just a little thick and strong, like honey that could be moved through. It even stained the blue sky with faint washes of gold. There was an apple in Maitimo's pocket. A sweet red apple that he had been planning to eat under a tree while reading a book, somewhere away from brothers and parents alike. But his plans for the afternoon had been spoiled somewhat by finding his cousin hiding behind a hedgerow, some way from the house. His little face had been woefully scratched up, and Maitimo had used his shirt to clean himself off. He'd had no handkerchief for the task. When Maitimo asked him how he had come to be in this sorry state, Bendicano had refused to say. Well, discretion was the better part of valor, Maitimo supposed, and besides, He knew where the blame lay. Chilcormo, after all, was nowhere to be seen, though the two were supposed to be playing, for sake of better relations between their families. And then Findacano had insisted on following Maitamo along all day, through his errands and now wandering home. They passed through a garden at last, and walked the stone streets to Nola Finway's house. Maitamo's flat leather shoes had clipped a little on the smooth stone, unused to the additional weight carried. Findacano was quiet, although if Maitamo strained his ears enough, he could still hear the faint snatches of song that he hummed, tuneless, but musical nonetheless. Maitamo shifted his weight and smiled, and remembered the afternoon that they had spent together. Maitamo did not find his young cousin to be at all bad company. Findacano did not insist on sweets as a means of persuasion, as Macalaure had done at his age, and nor did he wander off half as much as Chilcormo did, though Maitamo had discovered to his exasperation that when Findacano did wander off, he was even more difficult to find. But mostly, his little cousin was content to follow him around and pepper him with questions, when he was not staring at him with undisguised awe. This pleased Maitamo more than he was willing to admit, for his brothers, as young as they still were, had grown entirely used to him, and thus had grown totally unimpressed with all that he did. Finally, when they had come to a stone courtyard, not very far from Nola Finway's house, Maitamo set Findacano down on a bench and stretched, pulling his arms back behind his head. His back gave a little protest, and he uttered a quiet groan. He wouldn't be giving rides to anyone for a long time yet. Findacano settled on the bench, stone bench, and watched with him with wide eyes. "Cousin, were you always this tall?" "No," Maitamo said, sitting down beside him and stretching out his legs. He was not showing off, he was certain of that. "I was once as small as you." Findacano nodded solemnly. "A very long time ago." "Not so very long ago." They sat in companionable silence for a while, watching people hurry along, and also the ever-changing pattern of leaves playing on the stone wall in front of them. Findacano demolished the apple Maitamo gave him, and began to nibble at the core. Finally, with the sticky touch that all little boys seemed to have, he pressed a hand on Maitamo's arm and said, "Cousin, what of the friend?" "What?" Maitamo must have fallen asleep. He sat up, slightly mortified. Findacano gave him an indulgent smile. It looked a bit odd on his young face. Maitamo coughed to hide his embarrassment. Well, he thought about it, and then said, "One of my father's old tutors told me once that it was a friend that is a single soul dwelling in two bodies." Findacano considered this, tilting his head in concern. "That sounds painful." "I think it can be," Maitamo said, reflectively, a little surprised that Findacano should perceive this. "I am your friend, then?" Findacano said this tentatively, as if he were expected to be rejected, or worse, laughed at. "Yes," Maitamo said, with a laugh, which Findacano echoed happily. He clasped Findacano's small hand to his bigger one. "We are connected, you and I." I hope you've enjoyed this recording of Heartstuff by Agelast, the featured podfic for the Silmarillion Writers Guild, March 2014 newsletter. For more information about the Silmarillion Writers Guild, visit www.silmarillionwritersguild.org.